Whatever became of The Great Gildersleeve, number 2. My name is Richard Lamparski, and I better explain that opening, because I usually interview people just for people, but I can't very well say whatever became of Willard Waterman, because he's very active. He'll be telling you what he's doing in a few minutes, in case you live on the West Coast and haven't seen Mame, one of the biggest smashes on Broadway this season. But I had The Great Gildersleeve number 1 on this program in the fall of 1965. His name was Hal Perry. And in case you missed that program, maybe Mr. Waterman will explain all the difficulties there were with the part when it was they've changed actors, so to speak. But anyway, welcome, Willard Waterman. Are you living now in New York?
Well, I still consider Los Angeles my home. However, I have been here since February 21st last year when I came into set rehearsals on Mame. And as you can see, it's well over a year. And, of course, I don't know how long in the future I will stay. Mame is such a wonderful show, such a pleasant experience. Our girl Angela is such a lovely lady that the company is a very happy experience. And I certainly will stay with it until something better for me comes along.
Gildersleeve originated from the coast, as I recall, though, didn't it, Matt?
Yes, yes.
The TV series, too?
Actually, we filmed the TV series at the old Hal Roach Studios.
Mm-hmm. Were you out there when you were chosen for the role?
Yes, yes. I went to the West Coast. I was in Chicago from 1934 to 1946 in radio, all the old soap operas and the nighttime shows, First Nighter, Grand Hotel.
I remember that. The little theater off Times Square.
Smoking downstairs in the
Alhambra. In the Alhambra, please. Yeah. And he always got a cab right after the theater break. I could never understand that once I got to New York.
I think he had to wait in someplace. But in 1946, I was doing a show called Those Websters. And everything at that time was moving out of Chicago. And this was the last contract that I had left. And I rather assumed that in the spring of 46 it would fade from the air. So I came into New York here to look around and see if I could get my feet on the ground, decide whether I might like to try to make a living here. And I was here for 4 or 5 days, and I made some contacts, and I was all set, really, to move in here in the fall. 46, and I went back to Chicago and found not only were they renewing the show, but they were taking it to the West Coast. So we one Sunday did our show from Chicago, and during the week we all caravanned out to Los Angeles and did the next show from out there, and it continued for 2 more years, and which gave me an opportunity to break into West Coast radio, and then later, and also motion pictures, and later television.
You know, it strikes me as I sit here talking to you and looking at you and listening to you, I was going to say, before we met this morning, gee, your voice is so similar, because I'd heard it, you know, to Hal Perry's, but looking at you, do people tell you you look like David Merrick?
Yes.
It's amazing, really, how much you look like him.
As a matter of fact, I scared, I guess, Bobby Fryer, our producer, Fryer Karen Harris, to death when we first started wearing wardrobe and dress rehearsal. they had me in a Homburg hat.
Which is what he wears.
Which is what he wears. And I walked on stage, and he said, no, get that off of him. Get it off of him quick. So they put me in a bowler derby.
Have you met Mr. Merrick?
No, I haven't. But I saw him the other night on the Carson show. And I can see the resemblance. I mean, I'm sure...
Very definite.
If we, side by side, there wouldn't be any... it actually is like a lot like the resemblance between Hal Perry and myself. Side by side, we're nothing alike at all. Except that we both have a round face, we both have a mustache, we have a voice the timbre is similar. I think mine's a little lower than his, but the timbre is very similar. And people, naturally, because we both play the same character, people confuse us. But I have been in Hollywood and had people out of our studio audience when we were taping Gildersleeve show say, "Oh, I saw you on Waltz Time last night. You were wonderful." You wouldn't know, but that was a television show called Waltz Time on the West Coast Local Code that Hal was doing for a while. And I said, here he's looking at me, and he'd seen Hal the night before and still confused the two of us.
Well, now you have met then Hal Perry.
Have met? Oh, of course.
Did you know him before?
Hal and I both worked together in Chicago in radio for years. He used to play Hod Barrett on Tom Mix, the kid show Tom Mix, and I did Diamonds, the other villain.
That's funny. I remember your character, but not his.
You remember Hod Barrett?
No, but I remember Diamonds.
Yeah.
Who played Wrangler?
Percy Hemus, the old Wrangler.
Is he still around?
No, well, he was the original. And then, Percy Hemus was the... No, I'm sure he's not around.
Yeah, he did the commercials.
Yeah.
Take a tip from Tom, go and tell your mom that shredded Rolfs at Comedy Beat.
And Leo Curley, the sheriff. The sheriff, what's his name? It's funny how those things flow from you sometimes.
When you were picked to fill in for, to take the role of Great Gildersleeve, was there any hard feeling between you and Mr. Perry?
I don't believe so, no. Hal thought that what he was doing was right, and he it wasn't any question of my undercutting him for the job or anything like that, and we have been good friends since. A couple of years ago, we went on a Freedom Week junket to St. Paul together, and we had St. Paul completely confused.
Was he married when you knew him?
Twice.
Well, he is, I guess he's not a new wife now.
Yes, I met his new wife.
You have a girl from, I think, New Jersey.
Mm-hmm.
Because he said be sure to let her in-law or his in-laws know in New Jersey when the program would be on.
Yeah, I, when they were just married in 64, I believe it was, and he was going through Chicago to do Solid Gold Cadillac, I believe, up in Michigan, one of the summer theaters. And he stopped by the Schubert in Chicago and came backstage. And we spent really a lot of time together. We, as I say, back in the early days of the soap operas and First Night and Grand Hotel, it was one of those things when we both were cast in the same show, it was, you go high and I'll go low.
Was John Amici the First Nighter when you did it?
Yes, he was the lead in First Nighter. Not the First Nighter.
He played the Les Tremaine part.
Yeah, he did the leads. The First Nighter was Charles F. Hughes, originally.
Was there just one actress with him all the time, or were they...
Yes, no. June Meredith was the original lead in First Nighter. And then Ann Seymour was the lead opposite Don in Grand Hotel. And then... Betty Lou Gerson, I think Betty Lou Gerson replaced June Meredith. There might have been one in between that. And then, of course, Les Tremaine replaced Don. And after that, Olin Soleil.
And Barbara Luddy.
And Barbara Luddy, yes. And I think I even did a couple of these. Ed Prentice did a couple. There was one time during the transition between, I guess, Les and Olin, where they were sort of shopping the leads around. There was a special Christmas show that I would hope a lot of people would remember. I remember it very fondly. And it was done every year. I think I had the distinction of playing every part in it but Mary. At one time. Through the years.
For the benefit of young people listening who don't remember the debacle over the Great Gildersleeve, and for older people who, it's hazy in their minds, would you tell briefly what happened?
Well, as you probably know, the Gildersleeve character was originated by Don Quinn in Fibber McGee and Molly.
Right, he was a running character.
Running character in the show when the show originated in Chicago. And then that was probably about 38 or 39. I don't know exactly. Maybe it may have been a year earlier than that. But then the show, as a show, was taken to the West Coast, and Hal Perry, who was playing Gildersleeve in the show, went with the show. Then in 1941, Dean of Lewis and Broerby, who was the agency at that time, or another name now, they took the character, Gildersleeve, out of the Fibber McGee and Molly show and built the show around it for Kraft. And Hal played it on radio from 1941 until 1950, during which time he did three, I believe, RKO Gildersleeve pictures, which have recently been on television. So that's another area of confusion, I guess. In 1950, Hal left the show. It was during the time of, you remember, when CBS was doing all the raiding of NBC's talent.
When they brought over Jack Benny and Amos Landy.
And Hal's agency, talent agency, sold him on a contract to NBC. And I guess they figured that the show would go with him. But for some reason or other, Kraft didn't want to leave NBC. And so it came to the question of recasting. And I was not at all sure that I wanted to sort of put my career on the line in a replacement of that kind. And I don't think that Needham, Lewis, and Broerby were very sure what they wanted to do, whether they wanted to go with a similar character or something completely different, a different voice and all. And so they asked me if I would mind reading it. And I said, it's not an audition, but maybe, so we talked about it a good deal up till then. I said, maybe you will make a decision from having a chance to read it, and we also might be able to make our decision. And I went in and started reading the script, and I found that the character was so well written, so well determined, that there was no question of doing a imitation. It wasn't with the vocal quality that we had that was close. There wasn't any necessity of trying to imitate. It just, the character was a forceful character, and when you played it that way, it came out with the Gildersleeve characterization. That's all. And one thing that is unbelievable to most people, because they remember the Gildersleeve laugh.
I was just going to ask you about that.
And I didn't use it. I used to do what they used to call the Gildersleeve social chuckle, like, but the laugh.
So you see, you can do it, can't you?
I can do it, yes. And I get trapped because people say, "Let me hear you laugh," you know. So I can. But that was a characteristic. I mean, I laughed. Any character has to laugh. But I stayed away from that. I did all the the diphthong stuff. But the laugh as such, I didn't use. And nobody will believe it because it was so well implanted. But Hal used to use that laugh before he did Gildersleeve. He did a character called Professor Rowell on a show for Alka-Seltzer called Thank You, Stoogia, which nobody will probably ever remember. In fact, I don't know that we were talking about that Radio's Golden Age. I've forgotten to look to see if it's ever in there. It just occurred to me now. But he used that laugh then. And so I never did use that laugh as such. Anyway, I did the first program with much fear and trepidation, and fortunately the reviews were good and continued. And I did the radio show from 1950 then until 1959, and during which time I did the one season, 39 syndicated films of the Gildersleeve television.
How did the cast react when you went into the part? Because
well,
that, with one change, I'm again referring to that book you mentioned, radio's golden age, there was only one. I think Loreen Tuttle had played Marjorie, and Mary Lee Robb, I guess,
yes, did it. There was another one, Louise Erickson in between, I think. Louise.
But for the most part, I think they were the same actors right from the beginning, weren't they?
Yes.
Leroy and Gertie.
Yeah,
and
Walter Tetley, of course, was Leroy. Earl Ross, who was Judge Hooker, the old goat. And Peavy.
Wasn't there a Mayor Terwilliger? Was that?
Oh, yes, that was Stanley Farrar.
I just thought of that. Isn't that funny? I thought of that in years.
Yeah. And
they lived in Somerville.
Not Summerfield.
Summerfield,
yeah.
It's pretty close.
It was close, yeah. But the cast were, to answer your question, the cast were very nice, very helpful. They of course, had been used to Hal. And but they were very nice to me, and
they didn't feel resentful then.
No, I don't believe so. No. At least
actors are pretty good, I think, about that.
I think they all knew pretty much the circumstances surrounding it, and realized that I was in a pretty precarious position, quite a spot, as a matter of fact, in the replacement, and they were very helpful to me.
Do you ever see Ron Keith, who was your Leroy? I guess he's a big boy now.
Oh, yeah, I haven't seen him in... well, I have seen him since we finished filming the television series. But I understand he's quite a recording artist, and he was working hard on the guitar and singing the last time I
doubt very much that. I think the kids who listened to him realized that he was, you know, the little boy actor on that.
Yeah.
He's a young man now.
Oh, yes. He's, well, see, we did that in 55 and 56. And he was, I think we celebrated his 12th birthday, if I'm not mistaken, while we were on the show.
Frightening, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, we were mentioning, oh, you nearly laughed like that. We were mentioning Ferb McGee and Molly, who were, I think, one of the great, great teams on radio. And I understand began the first soap opera, The Smackout. So Virginia Payne tells me many years ago. And
well, that and I also did Colton Meyer's Kindergarten.
Yeah, I didn't know that at all.
Yeah, that was
that a Chicago show?
That
too?
Was a Chicago show. It was a network show, but it was originated in Chicago. And that was, I don't remember, was before or after Smackouts, or maybe along the same time.
Yeah. Because I guess they didn't choose to go into television and didn't continue in radio. And
they didn't want to do television, really. They did make a pilot, but very half-hearted. It didn't come out well, I understand, principally because they really didn't want to do television. They weren't interested. So
yeah.
They loved radio. And they continued to, even after the show went off for a long time, with those little vignettes on monitor.
Which were very cute.
Which were very cute, yeah.
Now Molly has passed away, God rest her soul.
Yes.
And Jim Jordan, who played Thurl McGee, remarried. And I understand moved to Hawaii quite recently.
Well, that I didn't know.
I just heard that, I think 2 weeks ago, I got a letter from somebody, and they said he was living out in Hawaii. But I have a recording of a Fibber McGee and Molly program for those who can't remember and those who would like to remember, too. And I haven't heard it myself, but I know it's funny and good because all their programs were. So if we're ready in the control booth, let's listen to... This is what Fibber McGee and Molly sounded like.
What are you reading, dearie?
Wimple's bird book. He left it here last night. And you never read such a miss of math information in your life. It's awful.
Well, if it's that bad, why do you read it?
It's so garbled, it fascinates me. This book has got more wrong answers than a nervous housewife on Take It or Leave It. Look at the title, even. American Birds and Their Habits. They can't even spell habits, you see?
Where?
There.
Oh, that word isn't habits, dearie. It's habitat.
Mm. Well, what I want to know is what their habits are. Who cares where they have their habits at? Any bird lover who reads this would throw eggs at the publisher.
Say, when did you become such a bird lover?
Ever since the first time I had quail with wild rice.
What particular statement in that book are you quarreling with?
Well, listen to what it says about the feeding habitats of the pelican.
All right.
It says the pelican feeds occasionally on other things besides fish, but it definitely prefers marine life. Now, that is ridiculous.
Why is it?
There ain't a pelican living that could get in the marine. They even turned me down twice.
Dearie, that isn't what that means.
Huh?
Besides, I think you're being too critical. After all, you're not much of an expert on bird life.
Who ain't?
You ain't.
Huh?
I mean, you aren't.
Oh, the heck I aren't. Who was it worked his way through high school raising baby chicks and even invented a slot machine that would dispense them 2 for a quarter? And who was it that a chewing gum took his idea and beat him to the patent office?
What chewing gum?
Chicklets. That's why I say these people would like to...
Come in.
Oh, it's Wallace Wimple. Hi, Wimp.
Hello, Mr. Wimple.
Hello, folks.
We were just reading your bird book, Mr. Wimple. Hope you don't mind.
Oh, not at all, Mrs. McGee. I'm glad to know where I left it. I'm afraid I was rather upset when I left here last night.
Yeah, we noticed that, Wimp.
Why? Did I do something?
Well, we had the radio turned on to a political rally.
Oh, I remember now. A deep voice snarled, Wallace is going to get the beating of his life. And I went right out the window.
Yes.
Silly me.
Hey, how are you getting along these days with her, Wimp?
You mean Sweetie Face? My big old wife.
Yes.
About as usual. We had a little tiff yesterday. Believe me, Sweetie Face puts up a tough tiff.
What was it about, Wimp?
Oh, it was nothing, really.
No?
She came back from downtown with a new hairdo and asked me how I liked it.
And?
I told her. Frankly, Sweetie Face, I said, it looks like an explosion in an Excelsior factory. I said, or a crew haircut with mutiny on the poop deck. I don't blame them for dyeing your hair, I said, but they waited too long to embalm it.
Oh, no.
Mm-hmm. And then out loud, I said... I said, it looks simply beautiful, dear.
My gosh, how could she object to that?
She knows me so well. She ignored the compliments on my lips and tried to slap the expression off my face. When I ducked, she... Oh, speaking of ducks, did you enjoy reading my bird book?
Yeah.
No.
What?
Confidentially, Wimp, this book is fuller of tripe than the inside of a cow.
Oh, I beg your pardon, Mr. McGee. This is the finest bird book there is. This is the authority on birds. It tells about the dodo bird disappearing, the migratory habits of the snow goose,
How
the passenger pigeon became extinct.
Wait a minute. What was that again?
You mean about the passenger pigeon?
Yeah, that.
Well, it says on page 49, and I quote, The passenger pigeon, which once swarmed over the North American continent by the millions, has become completely extinct. The last known passenger pigeon died in the Cincinnati Zoo in 1914.
Exactly. That's just what I mean. That is a falsehood.
What do you mean, McGee?
I mean I saw a passenger pigeon today. I've seen one every day for weeks.
Oh, my goodness, Mr. McGee, if what you say is true...
And it is.
If you actually saw a real-life passenger pigeon, why any zoo in the country would pay thousands for one.
You mean thousands of money?
Thousands of dollars for one pigeon, Mr. Wimple? Are you sure it was a passenger pigeon, McGee?
Why, sure I'm sure it was a passenger pigeon. Hey, if there weren't that kind of dough, I could trap that thing and sell it for... Oh, my gosh. Where's my hammer? Where's my tool? I gotta make a trap. Where's my screwdriver?
I don't know, Mr. McGee. I'm just a guest here.
Oh, I know. I left right here in the hall closet.
Now, don't open that door, McGee.
So that's what they sounded like.
Yeah,
I mentioned them so many times on the air.
That was Tommy Horan, the sound man, making the closet noises.
Was it really?
Yeah,
I didn't. He should have gotten credit for that because that was one of the most famous sounds, I guess, in radio.
So, yeah.
I wonder if kids listening in or young people who don't remember the program realize how funny that was. Everybody waited for it.
It was every week. And always waited until the last shoe dropped, you know.
Maybe I laughed out of, reaction or nostalgia, but it seems funny to me again.
I think anybody who heard the show regularly and realized it was a running gag, as you say, waited for it, and it probably wouldn't be terribly funny to somebody who heard it the first time.
That little bell at the end.
Yeah.
You know, my favorite character on that program and on yours was Mr. Peavy.
Oh, yes. Well, Peavy never appeared on Fibber. No.
Oh, really? What did they call him just then?
Well, that was Wallace Wimple.
Wallace Wimple, I'm sorry, because it was a very similar voice and character, I think.
Somewhat the same, yes. Peavy was a little more droll, and remember his famous line was, well, no, I wouldn't say that.
That was right. That, I always got that confused with my big old wife.
Yeah.
Which is what he just said.
Tweety Pie. Tweety Pie. That was Wallace Wimple's wife. Now, Peavy was the druggist and one of the Jolly Boys on Gildersleeve.
Mr. Gildersleeve sang, too, didn't he? Throckmorton.
Yeah, well, the Jolly Boys quartet was always a big item on the show. Yeah.
I remember Leela Ransom held in a trance.
She was the femme fatale, the southern...
Did she really have a southern accent?
It was Shirley Mitchell who played the part, and she... No, she wasn't telling
me. Did you wind up the show when you closed the series? Did he get married or was anything resolved?
No.
So they might come back anytime.
Oh, I suppose could, but...
still be the eligible bachelor.
Yeah.
Well, there's no reason why that would date, really.
No, there was no resolvement of his many peccadilloes.
Do you miss working on radio?
I think anybody that ever did. Work on it.
I always ask that, and I always get that answer.
Because it was. I think it was Burns and Allen. Excuse me. That made the statement. The more television they did, the more they realized they stole every dime they ever made at radio. And I think it's true. Radio was a wonderful medium. The facility that. The audience had of building their own sets and, in imagination, in their mind. There were shows that you could do on radio that would practically be impossible on television. I mean, I'm thinking one particular, Lights Out, which was the old horror show. With sound and mood, you could build pictures in the mind that would, in television, take the budget of a complete Alfred Hitchcock full-length movie. Because the effects were so easy to do. I remember one where somebody had their head chopped off, and it was very simple to chop a head of cabbage and have the head fall in the basket. It was a very terrifying sound on radio. Whereas, how would you do that in television?
Yeah, well, they chop heads, but that's how you see them.
Heads roll. There's no question about that. But it was a wonderful medium, and those of us, it was a great training ground. Many, many people came out of Chicago radio that have gone in pictures, in television, in the theater, and all facets of show business.
Well, I'm not a performer, but I know even when I, go around as I do to promote my book, to radio and TV. I always look forward to doing radio, even if it's an interviewer I don't know, or maybe I don't particularly like their manner. But I always like it because it's a fun thing to do.
Yeah.
I love radio. I look forward to doing this program and doing other people's. But television, I don't know. It means you have to go put on makeup, and I have to change my shirt, and is the tie right, and all of that. And it isn't the same.
Well, it doesn't have the relaxed quality. We had fun doing radio, a great deal of fun. I think the element that wasn't there was the great expense of production. That is, television costs so doggone much that you just can't fool around. For instance, when you're doing film for television, it's a matter of doing 35 and 40 setups a day so that you can get your 18, 19 pages. Radio, you had time. Although we didn't take a lot of time, most of the soap operas we did with 1 hour rehearsal. But there were amusing things and things that happened that you, I suppose, a little horseplay that kept it light and free and gay and there wasn't the seriousness that there is involved in television.
Well, this has been very enjoyable, visiting with you and hearing your voice again.
Yeah, well, thank you.
And if anybody wants to hear it even more, what theater are you playing in?
We're at the Winter Garden in Maine.
Maine. Smash hit. Well, thanks very much, Willard Waterman. Number two, Great Gildersleeve, and now star of Maine. Thank you.